as you can see from what I put on the board there, today is our weekly Q&A optional session. If you think it might be useful to have a chance to ask questions and or listen to me answer questions that other people ask, feel free to come to room 226. Other housekeeping, Mr. Simpson. Every Monday, 4 to 5 in room 226. I also will make a recording of it. So if you don't want to, or if you have some conflict or whatever, but you'd like to listen in and see what I had to say, then you can do that too. Mr. Tarasca. Going back to what was that Cardozo case? Yeah, Adams versus Bullock. At the end of that case, I asked the question, well, you know, what is this business about being an insurer? And Cardozo is making almost a sort of rhetorical point to say, look, the tort system, unlike the insurance system, is not a no-fault system. That is, the tort system is based on the idea that if the plaintiff's going to recover compensation, going to recover damages, the plaintiff has to establish that the defendant did something that deserves to make them liable, some sort of fault. Now, later on, we'll talk about strict liability, but Cardozo is not really, addressing the issue about is there some sort of strict liability theory like abnormally dangerous activities or something like that that would apply. Cardozo is saying if we made the trolley company pay for every injury caused by their system, regardless of whether or not they were actually at fault, then, well, that would be a bad thing, right? In other words, Cardozo doesn't explain to you why it would be a bad thing. He just sort of assumes, well, no, I'm not talking about that. I'm not that crazy, would be his expected, or the response he expects to putting the issue in that way. Now, just, you know, to sort of think about that for a second, I can't remember whether we addressed that at the time, but if you did make the trolley system liable for all the injuries, like the one that occurred to that boy, regardless of whether they were at fault, that would, of course, be better for the injured victims. They would recover compensation instead of having, as this boy would be forced, to deal with his, you know, burned, mangled hands without any help from the trolley company to pay for his medical bills or wage loss or other consequences of this injury. On the other hand, of course, making them liable for all injuries would drive up the cost of running a trolley. Maybe there's enough money in the trolley business that they could absorb that, charge higher fares or do other things, pay a little less to their stockholders so that they can still stay in business even though they're operating as an insurer. The other effect that it would have would be to make people less careful in their encounter with the trolley system. So again, one of the things the tort system does is to kind of affect who has to look out for whom. If the trolley system is liable for the injuries caused by the trolley system, regardless of whether anybody is at fault, then hey, I'll walk out into the street not looking around if there's a trolley coming at me, because hey, if I get hit by a trolley, that's their problem. They have to pay for it. Whereas if the rule is they only have to pay when they're at fault, then I'm going to be more on the lookout to try to avoid that sort of injury. So again, I think the general presumption, and as I say, Cardozo's simply referring to this as though we all understood it and agreed with it. He doesn't really argue the point. Cardozo is appealing to this notion that people should only be held liable when they are at fault, as distinguished from my insurance company, which is bound to pay me when I get hurt, even if, well, the insurance company's typically not at fault. I don't, you know, if my house burns down and I call up my insurance company and say, my house burned down, now I want you to pay on my fire insurance policy or my homeowner's policy, they don't say, well, we didn't do anything wrong. Hey, look, I paid my premium, I get my insurance coverage. So again, the relationship I have to an insurer is a different kind of relationship from the one I have with people like the trolley company, who only have to pay me for injuries I suffer if I can prove they negligently caused that. So again, it's the point of sort of recognizing why is it that Cardozo thinks he's making an important point when he reminds us that the trolley company is not an insurer, and if we're not careful, we could convert the rule into one in which they are essentially treated in that way. Okay, I believe we left off last time having sort of addressed in general terms Learned Hand's concept that the evaluation of negligence or its opposite, reasonable care, is essentially this comparison of the burden on the one hand, and on the other hand, the combination of how likely an injury is to occur and the severity of that kind of injury. So to give you a little more practical application of that, I had you read this Levi versus Slemko case, which uses Learned Hand's formula to evaluate the question of what is or is not reasonable care. Mr. Inouye, is that the way you say? Inouye? Tell me about Levi versus Slemko. Now, who is Slemko again? What's their, what do they do? Okay, so they're the electric company, yeah. Okay, so the plaintiff's argument is that the power company, if they'd been using reasonable care, wouldn't have located these wires in the place they did, making it possible for the plaintiff to get very seriously hurt. What's the power company's response? Okay, he was in a somewhat unusual position here, and he wasn't actually engaged in servicing the well. That's another little wrinkle we kind of come to later, which some of the judges think is a dispositive issue, that because the accident didn't happen while he was trying to do the thing that he's there to do, he was actually servicing his own rig, that makes a difference. But the thing the court is caught up with is the question of whether or not the power company, if they'd been using reasonable care, would have rerouted these wires to reduce the likelihood that an accident like this would happen. And let's first track this procedurally. What happens to the plaintiff's complaint? Does it go to trial? What's the story there? Okay, and a judgment notwithstanding the verdict comes after you've lost, right? In other words, the plaintiff, apparent from that we can infer that the verdict was originally for the defendant. So the case went to trial, the jury returns a verdict for the defendant, and the plaintiff then asks the trial judge, essentially, pay no attention to what the jury said. You should impose liability on the defendant because, judge, you know that I deserve to win. That's what the plaintiff says. And the trial judge's response to that, as you just said, was, no, you're wrong. I'm not going to overrule the jury. I'm going to let the jury's verdict stand. So the plaintiff's now appealing that, saying the trial judge should have, in effect, overruled the jury. And what's the plaintiff's argument on appeal? Why is it that the trial judge should have said, as a matter of law, the defendant was negligent? Well, and again, one of the reasons to track the procedure here is just to figure out what's the burden of proof. Remember that, like in the WASP case, the burden on the plaintiff was to show that as a matter of law, the plaintiff was entitled to recover. And if reasonable minds could differ about it, then the question goes to the jury. Here, similarly, the plaintiff is saying, in effect, the evidence is so overwhelming that a reasonable person could only reach one conclusion. And what's the basis of the plaintiff's argument when the plaintiff gets to the appeal court to say, as a matter of law, don't pay any attention to what the jury said. They found the defendant used reasonable care, but we know the defendant didn't use reasonable care. How do we know that, according to the plaintiff? Yes, sir. Yeah. And according to the plaintiff, what's the proper test? And how would we know it constituted an unreasonable risk of harm? Yes, sir. Yeah, here's an example, again, of how the plaintiff is taking this abstract theory and saying, look, it applies to my case, and run that argument for me here. How does that, hum a few bars of that for me here. Okay, and let's just talk about those in the context of this case. Is there a significant probability that over the lifetime of this facility that there is going to be a contact of some worker with this high voltage line? That probability is fairly high. We're not saying it's likely to happen, but you know, even if there's a 2% chance or a half a 1% chance, when you compare that to the second thing you talked about was, are bad things likely to happen if you hit a high voltage electrical line? Yeah, it's pretty grisly. Okay. Now, what do we compare those two things to? What are we talking about there? Yeah, rerouting these lines to reduce the likelihood that you're going to have an accident. And the court looks at this and says, relatively speaking, it's a modest kind of burden compared to the likelihood that somebody's going to get hurt. And on that basis, we can say, without paying any attention to the jury, that these guys were negligent. Now, this is a little bit not startling, would be an overstatement, but it, again, the court is being relatively muscular or activist here in saying they know from looking at this that it's a this was an accident that shouldn't have happened in effect. But not everybody agrees. There are actually two other opinions in the case at the end here. One concurring in the judgment, and again, just so we're learning how to read these cases, the concurring opinion agrees with the result, but it has some disagreement about, you know, further steps to be taken or about the reasoning used to reach the judgment or the like. And there's also a dissenting opinion which doesn't even agree with the outcome. What's the basis for the concurring opinion here, Mr. Inouye? And how would that affect this case? The power company and who else? Yeah, the plaintiff. That, if we're going to go around assigning fault here, maybe these power lines should have been put in a place where it would be harder for somebody like the plaintiff to come in contact with them. But after all, if you've got a rig like this and you know that the wells that you're servicing require large quantities of electric power, that they're transmitted with these high voltage lines, you'd think that the operator of such a rig would look before he ran this machine into its upright position. So, you know, don't we need to take into account his negligence in causing this accident? That's the point of the concurring opinion. What does the dissenting opinion say? Yeah, what are the circumstances here that make a difference to the dissenting opinion? Yeah, that's the difference. That for the dissenting opinion, if this had happened when he went to the well and was in the process of doing this, you know, paraffin extraction or whatever it is his job was to do, and if that's the way the accident occurred, that would tie into the idea of why the power company should have moved its lines. It was because of the risk that guys would have to, you know, drive up and be close to these wells to do their job, and that's why you should move the wires. Okay, in that circumstance, as the dissenting judge, I could see imposing liability, but this guy just pulls off the road. It happens that's where he chooses to, you know, clean his rig out or whatever it is he's doing, but it's almost a fortuity here. It's kind of a combination of lack of foreseeability and lack of proximate cause. It was as though you were negligent for you know, parking your car in a particular place, but then it gets struck by a meteor. Well, yeah, I wasn't supposed to be parking there, but not because of the risk of getting struck by a meteor. So again, the dissenting judge doesn't see the connection between what the power company allegedly did that was negligent on the one hand and this particular guy's injury on the other. So again, one of my purposes in giving you this case is simply to illustrate that sometimes, in some situations, this comparison, this explicit comparison between the burden on the one hand and the probability of loss and the magnitude of loss on the other hand, that will be persuasive. In fact, in this case, it was so persuasive to the appellate court, they were willing to take this case out of the hands of the jury and say, despite your finding that the defendant used reasonable care, we say these people were negligent. And that's the way the case turns out. Now, again, as we're sort of coming to the end of this section here, in which we've been ruminating, as it were, about, well, what do we mean by reasonable care? Exactly what is that standard that we keep making reference to? Notice that we started out with a kind of intuitive, certainly a non-quantitative idea. Reasonable care is what a reasonably prudent person would do. You know, would reasonably prudent people swat wasps? Would they pull over before they tried to deal with flying insects? You know, what's our sense about the way the ordinary, reasonably prudent person would handle that situation? Then we shifted, as you saw, to this kind of quantitative understanding that reasonable care is this cost-benefit analysis in which you try to get a handle on these variables, and depending upon the nature of the variables and how they play out in a particular case, that's what determines whether somebody met the standard of reasonable care or fell short of it and can be called negligent. Now, we had a little bit of discussion on Wednesday just sort of about the general philosophical issues, jurisprudential issues of what we ought to think about the place of this cost-benefit analysis, and at the risk of sounding sort of wishy-washy about it, I would say that in fact the legal system hasn't made up its mind and is inclined to sort of use whatever seems to be handy. That is, if you've got a case where this sort of quantitative analysis would be to either party's advantage, to the plaintiff's advantage or to the defendant's advantage, by all means, use it to your advantage. If you're the plaintiff and you can show that for a small investment in safety, you get a big payoff in terms of reducing accidents, well, you're likely to waive that in front of the jury to suggest that the defendant was negligent. And similarly, if you're the defendant and you want to show that the cost of preventing accidents would just be horrendous compared to the modest payoff in reducing accident costs, then you may want to do that too. Obviously, you don't want to run the risk of appearing to be too mercenary, as Ford appeared to be in the Pinto case. But to the extent, again, that looking at this from a sort of rational point of view suggests that the precautions are way expensive compared to their anticipated benefits, that argument may work to the defendant's benefit. On the other hand, we have lots of cases in which this sort of analysis would really be out of place. Again, you're not likely to whip out the learned hand formula if you've got a wasp flying into somebody's car and the question before the house is whether the defendant acted reasonably by, you know, swatting the wasp or what have you. So in a way, this kind of segues into the next section, which is assuming we have a working understanding of the standard of reasonable care, we feel reasonably comfortable in addressing what that is and how it applies in particular cases. What we then turn to, beginning on page 21 here, is to say, well, what are the sort of tools and techniques that can be used to make this persuasive case to the jury? To give you just sort of a visual or image or analogy for this, what we now the analogy I would give you is essentially that you're in the role of being a plumber, and you're preparing to equip yourself to go out and handle the kinds of problems that your plumbing customers are likely to have. And from job to job, the situation will vary. And when you go to try to fix a leaky faucet, or you've got somebody who wants to install a second bathroom in their house, or you've got somebody who's got a leaky or washing machine they need to replace, depending upon the nature of the job, you'll find different, you know, tools in your truck to come in handy. And what you want to be able to do is sort of practice using them in particular circumstances, so that as you recognize, oh yeah, here's where I could really use that pipe wrench, or over here I could use a the copper tubing, or a pair of vice grips, or plastic cement, or whatever it is that your truck may have in terms of tools that are available. The more things you're familiar with using, the more likely you are to be able to use just the right thing in the right place. And as you'll see when you look at the past exams, part of the challenge is not just, am I good at using a particular tool? Do I know how it operates and what its elements are? But can I recognize where one really fits and where it doesn't? So that it's knowing what the problem is, rather than being really, really good at even a variety of different things. If you pull up in your plumbing truck and go in and do a beautiful job replacing somebody's washing machine, that's not going to be as valuable if, in fact, what they really had was a leaky kitchen faucet. You know, making a good evaluation of what the need is, and then saying, for this particular need, here's the thing, here's the way you solve that problem. So again, what you'll see even on the mini exam will be a problem where there are a variety of different things. We say, well, maybe this would work and maybe that would work. I don't know if this would be helpful, maybe that would be helpful. But each of them has their own peculiar nature, and you want to learn how to kind of assess the situation and figure out what's really going to help. Now, I start on page 21 with this first heading of juror experience, and there's only a little paragraph here because there's nothing terribly complicated doctrinally about it. It's simply a reminder that at least some of the time, the jurors will be asked to make a judgment about something they have experience with. If it's driving a car, or you know, tying up a dog in the backyard, or sweeping a floor, or other kinds of activities where the defendant's behavior is easily susceptible to the juror's own assessment from their experience, that's likely to play a major role. They'll have, again, this intuitive sense about what's right or wrong. On the other hand, there are lots of cases where the jurors don't have the foggiest idea how you clean paraffin out of an oil well, or how you string a high voltage line, and therefore they begin to look to other kinds of techniques or standards by which to judge whether somebody used reasonable care or not. So the first of those, the ones that have a little more legal content to them, is this idea of industry custom, and we start with the Bennett case. Ms. Rush, can you tell us about Bennett? and there's a little ethnic slur here in case you missed it. I left that in there at the risk of offending people to illustrate the fact that, it is sometimes only a later generation that recognizes the inappropriateness of the way people express themselves or the ideas they have or the stereotypes that they hold. And we can certainly see that here. We would never put it in that way. Who knows in 50 years what we will look back, not 50 years, I guess we'd have to go 103 years, look back and think, wow, did we really say that? Hopefully over time we get better at seeing people without discriminatory lenses or being quicker to see the equal dignity of all human persons, but every generation has its blind spots, and we're certainly seeing one here. Okay, so his claim against the railroad is that if they had been acting reasonably, they would have put a lock on this switch. And what's the railroad's response to that argument? Okay, and then the jury listens to this evidence, but the jury decides that the railroad was nonetheless negligent. So the railroad's argument on appeal is what? Okay, so the question before the House then is, what's the relationship between the custom or pattern within the industry and the standard of reasonable care? The railroad says that once you've determined that the defendant lived up to, was operating within the custom, the standard operating practices of the industry, that should be, in effect, the end of the story. That is reasonable care. The plaintiff, on the other hand, would argue what? Yeah, the plaintiff would say that in the end, the jury gets to make that determination. Sure, they'll listen to the railroad. They'll obviously be influenced by the fact that the people who do this for a living chose not to use whatever safety device the plaintiff says they should have used. But after all, the jury, verse 3 of our hymn of praise to the jury, we want the jury in the end to be able to make that decision. Now, how does the appellate court resolve that issue? Yeah. So they, and again, the trial court decided for the plaintiff, so if they're reversing it, they're deciding this case in favor of the railroad. So they agree with the idea, in effect, who is the jury to tell the defendant how to run the railroad. And there would be many people today who would make a similar kind of criticism of cases in which complex questions about the safety of drugs or the design of airplanes or other kinds of complex questions or whether or not some cardiologist used reasonable care in performing heart surgery, and you have conflicting opinions between this expert and that expert, who decides that? Somebody who fixes mufflers for a living, and a retired waitress, and you know, somebody who runs an antique store, and you know, people that have no expertise, and yet these are the people who decide these multi-million-dollar cases about whether somebody was designed something correctly. But obviously, that's not the end of the story. In addition to giving you this Bennett case, I also had you read the T.J. Hooper case, and you'll see. Oftentimes, particularly in Chapter 1, I will give you these kinds of pairs of cases in which they address a similar issue, similar fact pattern. It may even be a you know, somehow a different courts or different years of the same court. Anyway, I give you these two cases, and either explicitly or implicitly, the question you ask yourself is, well, how can these cases be reconciled? Or maybe I have to admit that one's right and one's wrong, that they simply reach different conclusions about the same issue. So let's look at T.J. Hooper. Mr. White, can you tell us about T.J. Hooper? Okay, and what's the allegation of negligence? Okay, and so what was negligent? Was it negligent for them not to have a working radio? Is that the claim? Right. That the reasonable person, and the author of the T.J. Hooper case is our old friend Learned Hand. It's actually an earlier opinion. He doesn't come up with the Learned Hand formula until Carol Towing, which is, 16 years later, something like that. But same guy. He's obviously, one suspects he was working on something along those lines even as early as this. The argument might be that, again, the cost of the radio is small, the chance that it will prevent a catastrophe like this one is sufficient to justify its use. But we're not on the Learned Hand formula here. We're on the issue about the relationship of the standard of reasonable care to what is customarily done in the particular industry that the defendant is a part of. So, in this particular case, what's the evidence with regard to radios on tugboats? Okay. Now, there's also another wrinkle here. They actually had to have a different kind of radio, right? The statute required them to have... Right, a transmitting radio was required by statute. That's not really an issue here. That wouldn't have helped them. Nobody's claiming that. What they're claiming, though, is that the receiving radio, which apparently they had but had allowed to fall into disrepair, that a reasonable person would have had that in working order. And as you said, if we look at the... evidence with respect to the industry custom, it was mixed. Some had radios, some didn't. And so what's Learned Hand's conclusion as to whether or not the failure in this case to have a radio was negligent or not? Okay, he's got some language in this opinion that's actually fairly that is worth our time looking at more closely. But one of the things I want to do with this case, I'm sort of poaching on the territory of legal research and writing here, because there's an important principle of the way you read cases, the way cases are used in legal argument, to distinguish two aspects of the case. One aspect of the case is the holding. You know, what did the court hold in this previous case? And the holding of the case has to do with the nature of the facts presented to the judge, so that we can say, in a similar case, the court, following the principle of stare decisis, must follow the rule, or should follow the rule, unless you can find some reason not to. But if you've got a previous precedent where the holding covered the facts of your case, that's a binding precedent. And the holding goes to the nature of the case that's presented to the court. And in this case, the nature of the case presented to the court is one where there's a mixed pattern. Some have it, some don't. Notice the distinction between this case and Bennett. In Bennett, there was a consistent pattern. Nobody had these locking devices. Everybody in the railroad business thought that it was reasonable to have these temporary switches without any kind of locking device. Here, by contrast, some have radios. In fact, these people, the defendant in this case, had a radio and it just allowed it to fall into disrepair. You couldn't say there was a universal practice where they all thought that radios were a complete waste of time. Some thought they were, and maybe they just used them to listen to the Yankees games or, Glenn Miller or what have you. But they still had radios, and you would think that in addition to its entertainment value, the radio would be worth it in terms of alerting them to dangerous weather. So, again, you could, if you wanted to, distinguish this case and say, yes, Learned Hand was talking in T.J. Hooper about what to do when the pattern is mixed. He could choose to follow the more safety-conscious tugboat owners and impose the standard that a reasonable person would have a radio, and that's not inconsistent with what we said in Bennett, that that in effect the industry is smarter than we are. But then Learned Hand goes on in what is called dictum, or the Latin word for word, or the plural, words. It's usually prefaced by this adjective, mere dictum, mere dicta, meaning, that's just Learned Hand blathering about something or other. Don't pay any attention to him. Meaning that what's significant about the case is what are the facts that he actually ruled upon. We're stuck with those, but with respect to the dicta that he throws off while he's at it, we're not bound by that. And there's an important principle of not only of legal reasoning, but the sort of judicial modesty, as it were, to say the judges shouldn't go out deciding cases where the facts are not really before them. They should decide what the litigants have brought to them and be satisfied with that, rather than venturing forth to pronounce on issues that haven't been argued or presented to them. On the other hand, future litigants like to be able to go back and find a statement, even if it's mere dicta, that explains or generalizes some broader principle, so that we have some guidance. And judges who are deciding today whether a plastic bag in the trunk of a car enjoys a reasonable expectation of privacy depending upon whether it's a transparent bag or an opaque, that sort of thing, litigants want to know, well, give me something bigger than just plastic bags here. What is the general principle you're referring to? How will this apply in cases that aren't before you today but are going to come before you tomorrow? So in that language you were about to tell me about, this is where we get a very clear window into the mind of Learned Hand. And again, at this moment, he's not speaking effectively with the authority of the court. He's speaking for Learned Hand rather than for the Second Circuit Court of Appeals. But it turns out lots of people think he's right as rain on that particular point, and they treat it as though, well, they'd at least treat it as persuasive authority. So what is it that Learned Hand says here on page 24? You started to talk about it earlier. This is in the right-hand column, page 24, about six lines down. In most cases, reasonable prudence is, in fact, common prudence. It's a little difficult. He's not crystal clear. He's writing almost poetically here. But eventually, you can kind of figure out what he's saying. That is, if you look at what people commonly do, there's a sort of wisdom in that, we learn from experience, and what is commonly done has sort of stood the test of time and seems to work. You can usually infer what is reasonable by looking at what people commonly do. Then he says, but strictly it is never its measure. What he's saying is you can't make the leap to say that because it's commonly done, it is necessarily reasonable. And then the key part of it, a whole calling may have unduly lagged in the adoption of new and available devices. And here I think he's making a sort of political point. He's saying, think about this for a moment, folks. If we let the industry's common practices be what is reasonable as a matter of law, a whole industry may find it convenient to delay implementing some safety measure they know would lead to a reduction in injuries, but adding to the expense of their doing business. So we can't just roll over and play dead and say, oh, if you don't, find it necessary, who are we to tell you how to run the railroad? And he then goes on to make this more emphatic. It, meaning the industry, never may set its own tests, however persuasive be its usages. So again, a jury is likely to be influenced, find persuasive the common practice of an industry, but that's all they are, is persuasive. They don't get to set the rules that govern what is negligent or not. And this is where he gets up on his hind legs here. It says, courts must in the end say what is required. There are precautions so imperative that even their universal disregard will not excuse their omission. So again, he's speaking to a case not in front of him now, but he's planting his flag and saying, the buck stops here. I reserve the right as a judge, and I'll sort of bring the jury along with me in those cases that go to a jury. When a jury says they find an industry negligent, I will uphold that even if the industry is unanimous in its failure to adopt this procedure. So again, the contrast with the Bennett case where the court says, in effect, who are we to tell the railroad to run the railroad, how to run the railroad? Here, Learned Hand is saying anything less than this would be an abdication of our responsibility. We can't let the industry, in effect, become the government. We have to supervise them and, in the end, make our own independent judgment. Do we think they've been using reasonable care in failing to adopt this safety measure? Or do we think they've delayed this out of laziness or trying to save a buck? Now, again, it's a little bit harder in this circumstance to say that the industry has callously ignored other people's safety. After all, it's their own lives that are at risk when they head out. And if they don't have a radio on board, they're as likely to drown as lose their cargo. So the fact that they don't find it valuable would be persuasive. But again, Learned Hand saying that's, legally speaking, all it is persuasive. It is not dispositive. Yeah?
Is that logically applied to injuries? Would it also apply to other types of tort? Like, for instance, say, the ISP knows people are not using security for their downloading private documents.
Well, I think the issue with respect to, you know, the sort of property rights or facilitating copyright violations in the information world are a little bit different, but I think with respect to, you know, the kind of property damage that might occur, for example, from, highway accidents or that sort of thing, I think his principle is that industries have an incentive to reduce their costs, and we have to be vigilant that we don't mistake their penny pinching for a genuine technical assessment of what's reasonable care. Anyway, we'll finish up with that tomorrow and then move on to statutory violations.